Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. Thank you for being so patient with me because, well, I've been on my honeymoon to Texas. I have now learned how to say y'all all the time and everything, but truth to be told, it was really fun. But, well, I finally thought that it would be a nice time to get back to working because, well, lots of things have happened. And the thing I want to start with is the fact that today, May 7th, as I'm recording this, Mr. Putin was sworn in for his fifth term as the president of Russia. So he thinks that he is now the president. Meanwhile, the interesting part is that technically he is now officially a usurper. Since, well, he directly breaks his constitution, which states in pure Russian that no person can take more than two terms in office in a row. And it really doesn't matter to the constitution that technically, his term limit was nullified because Tereshkova, and I still don't know how she manages to still be active and do stupid things, well, wanted to do this, all this nullifying aspect. Putin, right now, well, as no one calls him legitimate, except very few people, but no one really cares, he, according to Russian law itself, is, well, not a president anymore. Now, of course, I'm not going to go into conspiracy theories like that. I'm not one of those sovereign citizens, nor do I follow the cult of Dita. If you just go back, there's an episode that explains Dita and sovereign citizens, because that almost drove me insane. But currently, what's happening is that, of course, he's not going to get arrested instantly, but theoretically, at least, what this means is that every person that works in the law enforcement sphere throughout all of Russia, well, they not only have a reason to arrest him, because according to Russian law, you know, he can't be arrested because of the international court, because Russia doesn't, you know, allow those courts' rulings to have any impact there, but, you know, now they have a duty to arrest him. And why this matters is that, say, Mishustin, Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin, who's been Prime Minister for a long while now, you know, he's a bit tired of this war and of all the dreadful aspects of life that it brings to Russia. And, you know, but he doesn't want to sit in prison himself. So if I was in his position, well, right now, as Putin is directly disobeying the constitution of Russian Federation, well, now if anyone in Putin's surroundings would like to arrest him, they can now do that very legally and straight up. Because, you know, the Russian constitution also holds a criminal punishment for starting an aggressive war. But then you'd have to go to court and do everything. No. Constitution in Russia works very clearly. Everything that's written there is just, you know, straight up accepted. No debates, no ifs or buts. It just exists. And in there, you know, Putin has just broken the thing about the two presidential terms directly, because they didn't change that stuff in the Constitution, which is just silly. At the same time, Putin's, of course, doing some threatening stuff, but we'll get to that later. As much as I wouldn't want to give you the persons who calls himself president of Russia speech, well, Medusa thankfully provided an abridged version of this, because, after the Dugin's interview, that was a bit weird, really. I don't want to listen to more Russian propaganda than absolutely necessary. Oh, yeah, and talking about that stuff, before I get to the main parts of all this, I will be posting, together with this episode, our commentary, where me and Alex of History Impossible, we watched whole Tucker Carlson's interview with Dugin together, and although the interview was only 20 minutes long, that scarred my brain to such an extent that I couldn't really force myself to even release a proper episode at that point. That was just painful. But if you want to see me or hear me suffer, then, and if you're a patron of this show, which you totally should be, then you can just put that on, download it straight up from Patreon. That's for free. To all our patrons, and then you can just play it in the background, start it first, then you'll know when to click the view button on Tucker Carlson's webpage and just watch it and hear our comments and, well, our prolonged misery, so to speak, because that wasn't an easy one to make at all. So with that out of the way, so that I wouldn't put it elsewhere, please consider supporting the show not only on Patreon, but just clicking the donate button on EasternBorder.lv, or if you're following this through Acast, they would normally tell you at the beginning, I presume, that you can just click the donate button there as well. So much appreciated. But now on with all the important stuff, as shameless self-plugging and monetizing out and shilling out of the way. So Putin said basically this, and it's heavily abridged, but otherwise you'd be here for, I don't know, 3 hours. And right now, as I'm finishing recording this, it's pretty late. Quote, "I want to thank the citizens of Russia. I want to pay tribute to our heroes, participants of the special military operation. Being president is a tremendous honor, responsibility, and sacred duty. With your choice, you have confirmed that the country is on the right course. This holds significance now at a time when we are facing serious challenges. I am confident that we will successfully navigate through this difficult period and emerge even stronger, and that the support of age-old family values will continue to unite us all. We are open to strengthening relations with all countries. We do not refuse dialogue with the West. The choice is theirs. Hold Russia back and continue aggression, or seek a path to cooperation. Dialogue is possible, including on security issues, but on equal footing without arrogance or bluster. We bear responsibility to our thousand-year history. Our progress will be even more dynamic and even more robust. We are one people, and together we will make our visions a reality. Together, we will triumph." Now, I don't really know how much he actually believes of this stuff. However, his attitudes toward the West are very weird, and I'll get to that next because, well, not only he had been into some arguments with Mr. Macron, but lately, yeah, he managed to anger Italy as well. The only person from the whole of EU who actually congratulated him actively was, guess who? Mr. Orban, of course. Whom else? But Russia now has confiscated or nationalized some Italian properties, which now has led to, according to reports from the Great Britain, to Italy actually being, you know, thinking about donating Storm Shadow missiles to Ukraine. At the same time, though, Italy has also stated that they would not approve of their use in Russian territory. But, well, Putin, even this whole thing about the Storm Shadow missiles and possibly even Taurus missiles, but I wouldn't count on that until I see them on the battlefield. Yeah, this came after that stuff. But this was just a bit crazy. Then again, his other escalation, which has led to even more crazy situation happening with especially France and his rattling the nuclear sabers once again, was created because of his conflicts with Emmanuel Macron. See, on May the 6th, Russia's defense ministry announced that it was beginning preparations for exercises, as said by Putin, quote, "to enhance the combat readiness of Russia's non-strategic nuclear forces." By the way, just as I was writing the script for this episode, I found out that Lukashenko, too, has, by the way, decided to test his own nuclear weapons, which he doesn't technically own, just Russia. Russia, theoretically, have only given Belarus access to nuclear weapons, but they're still Russia's weapons, and they would be used by Russian command, or so we think. But right now, Batka, the potato person, Lukashenko, has now decided to go out and, you know, join in into testing this whole situation. And this is quite a bit scary because Latvia is right next both to Russia and Belarus, and Baltics were threatened once again, and our neighbor to the north, Estonia, are now saying that we must prepare for a blockade of the Baltic Sea. And yeah, it's getting a bit scary here. In case of whatever, I'll let you know because, like I said, I'm probably going to call up the U.S. Embassy. I know you guys listen to the show, and in case something starts, because unlike other people, I am definitely on the short list to be, you know, hunted down. And, well, and at least I know that I have places to stay in Texas, at least, and New York, and all over the place in the States. So that's going to be a thing. But basically, Moscow stated that these drills are a response to provocative statements and threats against Russia from certain Western officials. Dmitry Peskov later classified, Putin's spokesman, that is, that the administration has in mind all the comments by Emmanuel Macron about potential deployment of NATO troops inside Ukraine, as well as basically the same stuff said by members of United States Congress, namely, I think it was the Democrat minority, minority leader, who said that the United States cannot allow Russia to win because then, you know, there'd be a much bigger war because there's no reason to think that Putin might stop. And I fully agree with this person. And also British representatives. And this escalation has been going on since, well, a while, really. And, well, let's just go through this one. Well, everything started on the 26th of February when Emmanuel Macron stated that, quote, There is no consensus at this stage to send troops on the ground. Nothing should be excluded. We will do everything that we must so that Russia does not win. Everything is possible, it is useful, if it is useful to achieving our objective. To which, on February 26th, Dmitry Peskov replied, stating the Kremlin's official position. In this case of sending troops, we should talk not about the probability, but about the inevitability of a conflict. That is how we assess it. Then, on the day after that, of February 27th, Jens Stoltenberg comes in, NATO Secretary General, and he said basically this, quote, NATO allies are providing unprecedented support to Ukraine. We have done that since 2014 and stepped up after the full-scale invasion. But there are no plans for NATO combat troops on the ground in Ukraine. However, then on March the 8th, Emmanuel Macron again states, quote, not ruling something out doesn't mean doing it. You're standing in front of me right now, not at home at your dining table, but you don't rule out that at some point you will sit down to eat at your dining table because you need to eat. It's all very flowery, but, you know, you get the point that Macron is saying we're not sending the troops now. 3! A bit later, on May the 2nd, he repeated this whole matter. Macron again stated that, quote, if the Russians were to break through the front lines, if there were a Ukrainian request to intervene militarily, which is not the case today, we would legitimately have to ask ourselves this question. So I think to rule it out a priori is not to learn the lessons of the past 2 years. This, by the way, ties into the fact that apparently NATO has drawn some red lines of their own. I hope they're better than Russian red lines, which don't really work at all. Just saying. And these lines are another country joining up the war on Russia's side, which basically means Belarus. If there's an assault on Kiev through Belarus, or if Belarus army also joining in, that's an instant NATO thing. If Russia decides to attack any other country besides Ukraine, not including just NATO allies, but also Moldova, then it's also, you know, then it's on. And then if the Ukrainian... And then I think it was tactical nukes or something, but there are red lines and plans being made for them. So that is kind of tying in with what Macron here is saying. David Cameron, on May the 3rd, stated, quote, by the way, at this point, he's British Foreign Secretary, so, you know, quote, Ukraine has that right to use weapons provided by London to strike targets inside Russia. Just as Russia is striking inside Ukraine, you can quite understand why Ukraine feels the need to make sure it's defending itself. Then, on May the 5th, the United States House Democratic Leader, like I said, and I found his name, Hakeem Jeffries, stated, quote, we can't let Ukraine fall because if it does, then there is a significant likelihood that America will have to get into the conflict, not simply with our money, but with our servicewomen and servicemen. Are we to believe that in the face of this kind of consistent aggression that if we allow Vladimir Putin to succeed in Ukraine, that he's only going to stop in Ukraine? Of course not. And I'm very happy to hear, you know, some sanity going on the West. Denis Shmyhal, Ukrainian Prime Minister, on May the 5th said the following, quote, if the time comes, we will absolutely be grateful and we will be glad to welcome additional troops from NATO countries. So, you know, those diplomatic plays are all over the place. And then, on May the 6th, Russian Defense Ministry released the following statement, quote, by order of the Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the Russian Armed Forces, the General Staff has begun preparations for conducting exercises in the near future with missile units of the Southern Military District involving aviation and Russia's naval forces. The exercise will include a series of activities for practical training in the preparation and use of non-strategic nuclear weapons. The exercise is aimed at maintaining the readiness of personnel and equipment. In response to provocative statements and threats from certain Western officials towards the Russian Federation. Again, diplomatic plays, they are, well, quite difficult to manage all over the place, after all. Then, also on May the 6th, Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin's press secretary, stated the following, quote, if you're asking me which statements by Western representatives we're talking about, obviously it concerns Mr. Macron's statement and statements from British representatives. If I'm not mistaken, a representative from the U.S. Senate, he really said Senate, and I know the difference between Congress and Senate, so, has joined them. They talked about readiness and even intentions to send armed contingents to Ukraine, that is, effectively to put NATO soldiers in front of Russian military forces. This is a completely new level of escalating tension. It's unprecedented, and it requires special attention and special measures. And here he's obviously talking about nukes, which is the same thing. Those are nukes. But again, and also Russian propaganda has been going completely crazy on focusing on like nuclear threats, because that's what they do, because Putin is paranoid. He's afraid that someone's going to backstab him in-house, so to speak, and he's also really afraid of someone pushing back on him. This is not some sort of thing that a wise leader would do. No, no, no. This is where you can see the Putin's real face. If he's panicking, if he's saber-rattling all over the place and being super loud about nukes, then, you know, he's just afraid. And I think Macron has caught this idea and he won't let go. Macron's here to stay and to focus on all these matters, because Putin's receiving some pushback. And Putin is very paranoid and wants to save his own skin more than anything. He wants to call to power. He's not a brave man, nor he's a master strategist. That's all he has, and he will never use the nukes. Because as soon as he does, which I still believe from the very first days of the war, if he actually decides to nuke something, although Maxim Kalashnikov, a friend of our good old buddy Igor Girkin, right, he's been constantly going on that Russia needs to break the nuclear weapons treaty, like nuclear weapons test treaty ban thing. I don't exactly remember the precise wording of that, but it was the treaty that was signed that stops nuclear testing in both like open spaces. So like on space, on the ground, all like, but it's not basically everything that's not underground. But yeah, the pro-Russian guys like this Kalashnikov, they say that Russia needs to show that it has and it is willing to use nukes by just blowing up some, I don't know, random bomb in Siberia, somewhere out there. Like far away, like Novaya Zemlya, places like that, like where everything's frozen. However, you know, if Russia hasn't done that and hasn't even mobilized once again, like the limited scale, so-called limited scale one, that's not really working out for them. Also, I still keep hearing all these words about Russia being able to replace 30,000 soldiers a month. I don't see the sources for that information. Even Simon Whistler on War Graphics, which I, by the way, highly recommend that you watch, because, I don't know, he really doesn't respond to my emails, but then again, he runs like 9 YouTube channels. So, hey, if you can email him, that's one guy that I like to have a conversation with. But even he quotes these ideas that Rush somehow is able to replenish these 30,000 a month. I just simply don't see how or when and where. So, who knows? But they have other issues, which makes it unlikely. And another reason why I really don't believe that Russia is going to do anything is that they're running into some economical issues. In late April, Russian government extended a decree requiring exporters to exchange most of their foreign currency earnings for rubles on the domestic market. Officially, these measures aim to preserve the stability of the exchange rate. However, despite all this, forecasts are really a grim picture, because Russian population really cares about how much the ruble is worth. That's the biggest issue since the 1998 bankruptcy, basically, the defaulting on loans. And they really focus on this, and Putin really wanted to keep this down before the election, before his inauguration, after all. And although the currency has somewhat stabilized around 90 rubles to the dollar, even Russia's own economic development ministry predicts a potential weakening to 100 to the dollar by next year. And, you know, they had taken some measures, and it was a bit iffy. See, in October 2023, and I love my economy. I watch all the economy things on YouTube. I've studied a lot of it, and economy part is where I feel quite comfy about, at least by this point, really. In October 2023, with the dollar hovering above 100 rubles on the Moscow exchange, Putin signed a decree mandating that 43 groups of export companies repatriate 80% of their earned currency and, well, subsequently sell 90% of that amount to the domestic market. They were allotted 2 months for revenue repatriation and just 2 weeks for sales. The Russian authorities at that point were thinking that if major exporters kept selling dollars, euros, and yuan, this would prevent a supply deficit and the ruble would stop weakening. The measure, which is supposed to be a temporary one, caused a share of complications, of course. Companies complained that sometimes they were paid in rubles, which then they had to exchange for foreign currency abroad, then they had to transfer it to Russia and sell again for rubles. And with China even like breaking down with their yuan and dollar bills, dollar sales, yeah, they're in a tough spot for currency. Sanctions also obviously made it difficult for exporters to transfer foreign currency to Russian banks. In light of this, the government made some compromises, amended the decree just a month before it was set to expire. Then, after some debate, well, they decided to extend the legislation until at least spring 2025, while adjusting some, some of the whole situation there. Exporters now have 120 days to credit foreign currency earnings to their Russian accounts. And it's difficult to kind of think about the efficiency of these measures, really, because Putin tested the mechanism back in March 2022. Then the Kremlin required exporters to sell foreign currency within 3 days of receipt, causing the dollar to plummet from 120 to 55 rubles. This time, the impact has been more modest. The dollar has gone down to around 90 rubles. Essentially, the decree didn't do much to change the situation, since exporters were already offloading a substantial portion of their foreign currency earnings. The regulations mostly just basically dissuaded anyone to basically do some short selling on the ruble's decline, you know, betting on that stuff. However, things do appear to have stabilized. At the time the decree was signed, the ruble had been steadily weakening over the preceding 10 months. Now the rate has remained relatively stable for like last half a year. RBC calculated that the ruble depreciated by only 0.5% in April, writing that it's hard to imagine a calmer month on the foreign currency exchange. BCS Financial Group echoed this sentiment, saying that the exchange rate volatility is the lowest it's been in 3 years. Kremlin asserted that the implemented measures have demonstrated their effectiveness and helped stabilize the situation. Russia's Federal Financial Monitoring Service, which is very stupidly, as everything there, renamed Rosfinmonitoring, tasked with overseeing compliance, claims, again, official data, and we do not believe Russian official data here in this podcast, as you probably know at this point, because there is no reason to. They claim that the exporters have been fully adhering to these things, and I bet some of them have. Some of them definitely have. Now, critics of these mandatory sales contend that the situation is improving without any additional demands on exporters. The most influential proponent of this view is Russian Central Bank head, our good old buddy here, Elvira Nabiullina, Sahibzadovna, by the way. She opposed such regulations from the outset, asserting the central bank measures would be enough to strengthen the ruble. In the summer of 2023, the central bank began raising the key interest rate in an effort to curb inflation. The higher key rate should also dampen import demand, consequently weakening demand for foreign currency and easing pressure on exchange rate. Another side effect of this is that elevated interest rates should incentivize exporters to sell their earnings on the domestic market, to fund local operations rather than take out costly loans. A high interest rate also makes holding savings in rubles more lucrative, which, you know, is noted by analyst at Sovcombank, Mikhail Vasilyev. Opponents of further regulations also highlight the rising price of Russian raw materials. While oil prices began climbing as early as last summer, this has a delayed impact on the exchange rate. Tankers first have to reach India or China, and then it may take time for local companies to find a way to pay Russian suppliers, well, due to obvious sanction risks. In the fall of 2023, Sberbank, their one of the biggest corporate banks in Russia, it's savings bank, and it's a I have to make a whole episode about Sberbank so that it will be understandable to you guys. Sberbank CEO Herman Greff predicted that the ruble would strengthen to around 90 to the dollar and stabilize without government intervention. The central bank opposed extending the decree, citing positive market factors for the ruble, such as reduced imports due to payment and logistics problems, and increased exports, driven by soaring oil prices. However, there are analysts such as Yuri Kravchenko from Veles Capital, emphasize that the stability of currency inflow, which mandatory sales ensure, is important for the market. Despite currently super high prices for these raw materials, low trading volumes in recent years have fueled sharp fluctuations in the exchange rate. If the decree were abolished, volatility could increase. BCS Financial Group predicts that without the support, the ruble could depreciate to about 97.5 against the dollar. At the same time, economists don't expect the ruble to strengthen as a result of the decree's extension. There will simply be fewer triggers for sharp depreciation. Igor Sushin, the managing director at Gazprom Bank Private Banking, because of course Gazprom also has a bank, described mandatory sales as a, quote, crutch designed to smooth out imbalances, but said that they've helped make the foreign currency exchange market less sensitive to economic shifts. While extending the decree may increase transaction costs for exporters, Sushin believes that benefits outweigh the drawbacks. Despite various regulatory measures, most forecasts, including official government assessments, paint a bleak picture of the ruble's trajectory. Initially, Russia's Economic Development Ministry projected an average exchange rate of about 90 rubles to the dollar for 2024. However, Economic Development Minister Maxim Reshetnikov later updated this whole thing to 94.7 rubles to the dollar. Moving on from the yearly average, analysts from various economical channels that I follow through, mostly MMI, but there are others, they say it's around 99.5 to the 100. About 100, even maybe up to 120, is where Milov from the Navalny's team also sits in this opinion. At one point, by the way, later on, Ministry, their economical ministry, outlined an alternative, worst-case scenario. Pressure from the sanctions could cause oil prices to plummet to $51 per barrel, hastening the ruble's depreciation. If this happens, the average exchange rate could soar to 120 rubles per dollar by 2027. But I really don't think it's going to even go to 2027, really. Adding to concerns, despite overall high oil prices, Russian exporters are often forced to sell at a discount to incentivize buyers wary of running afoul of sanctions. And here I'd like to note that in this quarter, in the first quarter, Gazprom, the main exporter of gas in Russia, has, for the first time ever during its whole existence, ever, projected a loss. They made no profits. Gazprom, who has been like giving all the money and that's the big milking cow for all of Russia's economy, yeah, they have actually gotten to a loss because of all the Ukrainian strikes against oil refineries, which is amazing for us, but it's just weird. Weird to see how these strikes on refineries are really hitting the Russian economy. And if even Gazprom is struggling, then everyone else will follow as well, including the smaller gasoline companies that provide, you know, fuel for the cars to the average Russian. Because it's gasoline prices, same with, you know, ruble to dollar, has always been a very volatile thing in Russia, where people really pay attention to this. And gasoline in Russia is ridiculously cheap by both European and United States standards. However, that has also been kept this way by, you know, Russia having insane amounts of oil and gas and making just tons of profits. But right now, a lot of these smaller companies as well, not only Gazprom, you know, they are in the red, because they have been using all their surplus capital to basically not increase the prices, because, you know, some nasty folks from Kremlin basically declared that, oh no, if you raise prices, we're going to yell at you. And, you know, there might be some fluctuations in the windows and their openings and, you know, people trying to learn how to fly, all that sort of thing. If you remember Lukoil, which is one of the biggest oil companies, their owners have been enjoying flying off everywhere, basically. But, yeah. All this is a big mess. Central Bank, by the way, Russian Central Bank, regularly surveys dozens of professionals and publishes a consensus forecast. In April, they projected an average rate of 92.9 rubles to the dollar for this year, worse than their previous one of 91.2. An investment director of Astra Asset Management attributes this to factors such as robust domestic demand, reduced exports due to the sanctions, and increased capital outflows amid income growth in an, quote, overheated economy, end quote. He anticipates himself dollar climbing to 95 to 100 rubles by the end of the year. Alpha Wealth analysts also note that the ruble has stabilized for now, but caution that exchange rates in the 92-95 range are still too high. Moreover, they point out that the ruble is, quote, mathematically much more likely to weaken than to maintain its current position or strengthen, both because of high inflation. The real inflation of everyday household goods in Russia, Russia has been like over 30%, and in some cases, if you count from start of the war, like at one point they measured for cucumbers. Like cucumbers and eggs were the hardest hit things. I think they've increased about like 400%. I think one of them was 300. I think cucumbers were 350% increase since 2022, and eggs were about 400% increase. It's just crazy amounts. And especially like medicaments and like all sorts of medicine, that also has massively increased in prices. It's like everyday household goods. Inflation doesn't really hit. Inflation hits businesses, of course, but it also hits everyday population, which is in a massive, massive trouble. So hitting them once more with mobilization might not be such a good idea. At this whole time, in a way, by the way, Russia's other measures are starting to falter. The Russian government currently is selling off more foreign currency than it's buying, but the margin is very much narrowing. Any further closing of this gap would adversely impact the ruble's value. Additionally, Russia is voluntarily cutting oil production and exports in coordination with OPEC Plus countries, further reducing the inflow of foreign currency. And also, of course, we have to mention the drone strikes on Russian oil refineries, which threaten fuel supplies, prompting the government to impose a ban on gasoline exports. In light of all these factors, Sber SIB investment research analysts predict the ruble to weaken to 95 by the end of the spring, and we'll continue trading at this rate through the end of the year. So it's not a nice outlook. They're really, really pushing through to get their stuff in order, to manage something, because it all looks very, very threatening. So we'll see. I don't really think that in this situation, with this economy, because Russia is hurting bad from all this, I really don't think that in this economy they are ready and willing to annoy someone. And the fact, like I mentioned in the beginning of the show, the fact that the Russian government itself isn't that secure about its position, the paranoia of Putin, I think the system grinds slowly and carefully, but it works. It really works. And I hope that it will continue to do so. But yeah, that's it for today. I'm glad to be back to work properly. Yay! Also, I have to give a shout out as I'm finishing this recording to Bayer Leverkusen, who are, I really, really hope, on their way to basically do an unbeaten treble. I'm sorry for talking about soccer and football. Those of you who are not interested, you can turn this off, but please wait until the end because I need to gush about the Champions League. And today I want to congratulate Viktors, our great camera guys, hometown of Dortmund, whose Borussia just beat Paris Saint-Germain and managed to go to European Champions League finals, which I find amazing. However, I'll be carefully following Bayer Leverkusen actions because they're doing something unbelievable. And I just need to talk about this. Like, again, I gave you a proper episode, so please hear me out. Basically, they have been... those of you who are in Europe, you already know. To all of you Americans, just YouTube's explanation of European soccer, football, and be done with it. But these guys, they're participating into their National Cup, National League, which they've won already, and Europa League. And they haven't lost a single game in their whole season in all these three competitions. They've gone 48 games without being beaten. And they only score goals, like, they have scored scored like in the very last minute of the game, starting from 89th minute, about 14 times. They managed to pull off insane comebacks. These guys have everything going for them, and they just might pull off the thing that has never happened before. It's insane. It's crazy, and I love it, and I'm just enjoying this, and it really keeps my mind off of more horrible things. And I look at my computer where the Dugin conversation file has uploaded for patrons, and oh yeah, that's gonna hurt. That's gonna hurt if you listen to that as well. But yeah, wanted to ask you, if you're from Germany and you have like a local store with Bayer Leverkusen shirts, I would be super happy to get one, this season's one, because everything's sold out online completely, which I understand because they're doing insane, crazy things. They're being very good, and it's so great to be able to follow them, especially before the Euros and everything. But their shirts are just sold out all the time, and I really want their shirt from this season because I believe they're going to do it. So that's it for today. We'll be back very soon. До свидания, товарищи. As always, remember, happiness is mandatory.